This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, my dear friends. It is your boy, Michael Cruz Kane, back again with another episode of A Good Cry. This one is the season finale for season two. And man, what a great season it has been, if I do say so myself. I have enjoyed it very much. I hope you have too. We've had all kinds of grief. We've had all kinds of guests. And it's just been the time of my life. Incredibly sad, incredibly joyful, and enriching, if I may say so. This is the season finale, so we're going to be going away for a little bit, but we will be back. Thank you in the meanwhile for all your DMs and emails, and thank you for reviewing and sharing the show with your friends and enemies. Why not? But I'm going to take some of this time to respond to all the messages you guys have been sending me. I really appreciate them. I promise I will get to every single one. And one more thing, which is that I'm still doing my one-man show, Sorry for Your Loss, off-Broadway in New York City. If you're around, check it out. SorryForYourLossShow.com is where you can get tickets. We were supposed to be going until June 4th, but we have been extended a week to June 10th. Can you believe it? I hope you'll come. It is funny and it is sad, which is kind of my whole deal at this time. And without further ado, let me move on to this episode, which features the brilliant Moshe Kasher. And if you don't know Moshe, that is a shame on you. He is a brilliant stand-up host, author, probably every other thing. I bet he's amazing at pickleball. I don't know. But he is a jack of all trades as well as a master of all trades, as far as I can tell. Everything I've ever heard or seen him do has been amazing. We talk about the loss of his dad. We talk about AA. We talk about his ever-changing relationship with his faith. And he is just one of the easiest people to talk to. He is constantly entertaining in addition to empathizing. And because he's so brilliant and gets so in-depth, even when you think there's not room for it, he's also edifying. It's a brilliant conversation, one of the best I've had ever. Not even on this podcast, just in my life. And it moved me. I hope it will move you as well. I'm sure it will. This is A Good Cry with Moshe Kasher. Thanks for listening. I hope it helps. Moshe, the way we get our podcast starting is by asking the... Did I say starting?
You did.
The way we get our podcast started is by asking the question, how would you describe your relationship with grief?
I guess I think that a lot of who I am is a product of grieving the person that I used to be. So I would say it's kind of an ever-present part of my life. And I also think that having lost a parent young, I feel like it kind of calcifies you into this kind of secondary kind of person. I know you've experienced loss too. I wonder, and I know it's a very different kind of loss. Like, I wonder if is there a, you know, when you lose a parent young, you kind of seek out other people that have lost a parent young. And they're like the only real people. It's almost like, do you ever take acid?
I haven't.
You should do
yet.
It. You should. Okay. I'm going to come over actually and bring you some. But when you're on acid, I don't know. I've only done acid as a teenager. But when you're on acid, like all the non-acid people look like these kind of weird aliens. And they freak you out and you don't want to be around them, which is a difficult thing for me because I've been sober for a long time, and I go to a lot of psychedelic music festivals, and I always notice that there's certain people that I'm friends with who then will all of a sudden be avoiding me. I'll be like, what happened? They're like, oh, he's on DMT. That's what's going on there. but when you're on acid, I remember like only the other people that were high were the people that felt like real human beings. And it felt similarly to me after I lost my dad. Was like, nobody my age had stepped beyond the veil of grief that I had experienced. And so all I wanted was for people who had that experience and could download with me, I wanted to surround myself with people like that. So I don't know.
That makes a lot of sense to me from my point of view. Similarly, I mean, the losses are different, obviously, but losing a son at the age that I did also felt like very unique. It felt like, you know, I wasn't able to talk with people who had gone through something similar. So yeah. I didn't even know that I could seek them out, because the loss of a child is like nobody, in my mind, it was like, this has never happened to anyone ever. And it might've felt like that to you when you were 20 and your dad died. I don't know.
I don't know what you, obviously I can't even imagine your experience, but I feel like there's this thing that happens when people die. And I imagine it's even more profound when it's such an unexpected, I mean, at least people expect that your parents are not going to be with you forever, but you find out immediately. I found out immediately how ill-equipped everyone is at interacting with you in that experience. And I imagine it's even more acute when it's one that's not expected. And it's almost like, you know, when you get, like, you know, we all went through COVID in the last few years. And when people, in the early days, when people get COVID, you kind of would be like, I don't even exactly know how to interact with this person. Like, are they a Scarlet
Letter? Is this a dead person?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I remember everybody interacting with me at that. I was 20 years old, and I remember everybody that interacted with me was trying. And I became so acutely aware that the world really doesn't teach people how to deal with friends and dear and people in your life that have experienced a deep loss. Everybody was trying so hard, and nobody had anything for me, except the people that had gone through the loss.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. How did you find people who had been through it? Like, did other people come out of the, like, sometimes people come out of the woodwork, or did you have to like seek out a dead dad's club or something like that?
Well, I do feel, you know, there is the dead dad's club, and it's all young people who have experienced it, and then we kind of like high five, and go like, and so when I meet someone who's experienced loss, especially a person that's young, you know, I will do this bizarre welcoming and go that, you know, it's a terrible club to join, but you know, but we've got your back or whatever. But yeah. I had a dear friend who had gone through the same loss that was in my life at the time, and it was extremely helpful. And I sort of feel like if I hadn't had that person in my life, I would have been lost. And you know, the other thing I think a lot about is my main processing of my, this was a bad few years. I lost my father got sick in May, and he died in June, I think. And I was there, and it was heavy. It was, you know, I've been thinking a lot about it because I've been writing about it recently because my wife's father just died. And so I was thinking about my own experience. And we went to visit her father this summer, and he was sick and he was not doing well, but he was there. You know, we went out to eat, we went to the beach, he was struggling, but it was like, all in all, it was a pleasant interaction. And I, when we left, we were leaving from that trip to go to England to go do, be on this panel show in England. I just told my wife, like, that was the perfect final visit, because my experience was my dad got sick in May. I was young and I was broke, and my brother and I sat down with our sponsor in AA. And we were like, what do we do? And we decided that one person, that my brother would go and that I would stay. And my brother would go sort of scope the scene. And he went, and he had the trip that my wife got. They went on walks together. They talked about my brother's childhood. They talked about, you know, mortality. They talked. And then I got the call when it was like time to go. And as I write about in my second book, time to go means it's too late. You know, it means like time to go means you should have gone earlier. And when by the time I got there, I remember, and this is one of these grief memories that I, you know, you have, I wonder what your experience is, but you have these memories in grief where you, there are things that you wish you could take back and things that you wish you could do over. And they have these profound experience because the timeline is like ripped in moments of this grief. And so everything feels outsized and super important because it's this incredibly emotionally intense experience. But I remember that I walked in, I took a plane from Oakland to New York. I took a taxi from the airport to Brooklyn. I took a ride from Brooklyn to the hospital. I took an elevator from the bottom floor to my father's floor. I took a walk from the elevator to my father's room. And I got in the room. I looked at him and I was like, oh, I have to go. He was so sick looking. I was so, you know, slammed with his physicality. He was sucked up. His teeth were sticking out. One of his eyes was shut from a tumor that was growing behind his eye. And I pretended that, I forgot something, actually. I came all this way, but I actually, there's something in the hallway that requires my attention. You give me a second. So I literally immediately turned around and left because I felt like I was going to like pass out or rip in two. And my dad knew what he knew. I mean, how could you not know? He knew what was going on. And he asked my brother. My brother told me later, is he scared of me? And I was, you know, I mean, I was terrified of what I was looking at because it was like, oh, there's no hope in this room. And so then I was there in that hospital. I don't think we left until he died. And that was about, I don't know. Oh, I did leave. I'll tell you that story in a minute. But that's another moment I wish I could get back. But I was there until he died. And then 6 months later, my grandma went to the hospital who had raised me. She was a secondary parent. And I was with her for the last 6 months of her life and caring for her in a really hardcore and intense way. And 6 months after that, my fucking dog died. It was just this like, come on,
dog.
The dog has to die as if to just punctuate this. So it was definitely, I got my experience in grief basically in a 1.5 year period all at once. And I felt like I emerged like a different human being, an adjusted man.
You write about, and I've already talked about on this podcast, like, you know, having a sponsor and, you know, using various substances and being sober. Was it hard to not backslide in your behavior when with all this tragedy kind of piling on top of each other?
You know, I've always thought that the idea of the alcoholic addict, by which my relationship with the idea of the alcoholic addict, period, is very complicated these days and has become a lot more porous and a lot less static. But I still think so that is to say, almost all of my beliefs about what alcoholics are like is, I don't know what I believe anymore. But I think I still believe this, which is this idea that, you know, the recovering alcoholic needs only to experience a trauma so great that he will turn and say, maybe I will find solace in this substance or in this bottle, is a bit of a myth. You know, in my experience, yes, that definitely happens. There's no question about it. And maybe you're in recovery, I assume, by what you're saying.
I'm not. You're not. Only seen a lot of movies.
Well, the movie version is exactly that. The man is sober. He's doing fine. He's wrenching on a motor because he got his old job back at the mechanic. Things are going pretty well. But then all of a sudden he comes home and his wife is fucking the mailman. And do you swear on this podcast? His wife is bopping the mailman.
Yes.
And,
yeah. Please only say bopping.
And then he turns around and he goes to the doctor and he's got cancer. And then he turns around and his mom gets hit by a car. And then he goes, oh no, it's all falling apart. Oh, I need whiskey, right?
Now, right, he buys like a 24-pack of Four Loko to help him cope.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Like, I think that, I'm sure that that happens. You know, I always say about everything, there's 6 billion people in the world, so every iteration of everything has happened. But much more common in my experience is everything is going fine and you're not paying attention and you're not working on yourself. And one day you just make this decision like, you know what? A cocktail would actually be really nice. So no, the answer to your question, no, it never really occurred to me. It has occurred to me in other times and other ways, but the grief never had a relationship with, I could get out of this in a bottle. Now, had I not been working on myself, had I not been, you know, involved in recovery at the time, maybe it would have occurred to me. My way out, my treatment, and I don't want to be too dogmatic, but it is so connected to my relationship with grief, is I found the Jewish religion, and I am not a particularly religious guy. My dad was, and my brother is. My brother's a rabbi, and he was not that religious when my father died. I found this grief ritual in Judaism to be so profoundly useful that it made me wonder, what are other people doing? What are people that don't come from a faith, or people that have lost their faith altogether, or people that, I don't know what other faith traditions do, but the Jewish grief ritual is so didactic and it's so just stratified that it just, it tells you exactly what to do, how to do it. And it was so comforting, because I feel like the main thing that you don't know when you lose someone close to you and you're in a grief state is what to do next.
Yeah. And the idea of, well, you're talking about sitting Shiva, right? And then,
well, Shiva's complicated. Do you know about the whole thing of Shiva?
I mean, I will tell you that my relationship with Judaism is that my dad is Jewish. I was bar mitzvahed, period, end of story.
Well,
so I don't.
Let me tell you, and let me tell your listeners, Judaism is the truth. Capital T. And if you aren't on that path, you are on the wrong path. The grief ritual in Judaism, like, is very structured. So you come home, and I mean, I don't know how long you want me to talk here, but I could tell you everything.
Just go forever, as long as you want.
Well, a lot of strange things happen. But let me tell you about here's how the whole ritual goes. When it becomes clear that there's no hope, and I remember the moment that it became clear there was no hope. We were standing in a hallway in a hospital. And, you know, these hospitals, when you lose someone in a hospital, hospitals become tainted. Like when you have food poisoning and you can never eat that food again, you know, they come to feel like that. I don't think I've been in a hospital since, maybe until my daughter was born in a hospital.
No, I have that feeling. My son died in the hospital, and I like to think of myself as, like, you know, bigger than trauma. But when anytime I get in a hospital, I feel like an anxiety that I never felt prior to that happening. I'm always like, this is the wrong place to be.
And it's a sensory, I don't know if you have this experience, it's a sensory anxiety. The smell of a hospital immediately is like, oh, it becomes like curdled in your nose. And forever, like, you have this feeling of just like, this is where my grief came to really experience itself. But anyway, we're in this hospital, and the doctor pulls us all outside, and he says, like, you know, your dad has slipped into this phase where the cancer is killing him and he needs more medication, but he's so weak from the cancer that the medication will kill him. It's kind of like end game. And I remember my little sister asking, is there anything we can do? And the answer was not what she wanted. And it was just like this shifting reality of, oh, this is kind of over. And at that moment in Orthodox Judaism, now this isn't the comforting part. At the moment of it's no longer, there's no hope, these sentinels come in from the community because they are very worried about everything being done properly, right? And the non-religious kid from the first divorce can't really be trusted to observe and make sure that everything is done properly. So all of a sudden, this very surreal thing started to happen, which is that distant cousins, people who I barely knew and who had occupied in my life a space of, because just to contextualize it for the people listening, my parents divorced when I was young, and my father became like a born-again Orthodox Jew. And then he married a woman that was in this Hasidic community called the Satmars, who are the most extreme of all the Hasidic Jewish groups. So my dad slowly drifted into this community that was like, did you see Unorthodox on Netflix?
I sure did.
That's about the Satmar community. So those are the people that my father married into. I'm a public school kid in Oakland. And I would fly back home and fly back to my dad and put on a Hasidic Jewish costume and literally pretend to be a Hasidic Jew for 6 weeks a year. And it was filled with shame and embarrassment. And it was just one of the most uncomfortable. I just felt like a walking, you know, error my entire childhood when I was there. And then all of a sudden, in this moment of grief, these people who I was like felt less than and felt judged by were in the room with me. People who'd never had a conversation with my father, really, were sitting in the room with me during the final hours and the final days and the final weeks of his life as observers to make sure that the moment he died, everything was like super clean, super kosher, wrap him up, everything according to the rule. And so it was a very, you know, because grief is so incredibly intimate and loss is so incredibly intimate, And then you just look over and there's this like Hasidic kind of, you know, goon squad guy there just like kind of observing. It was a very surreal experience.
Can I ask a question about that?
Of course.
Before you move on to something that I'm sure is equally, if not more, fascinating, do you know what the consequence is if things are not done? Like, that's the thing. A thing about Judaism, which I understand, you know, vaguely is an overstatement, is that, like, in Christianity, I went to church for years when I was a kid. Like, there's the system is set up like you
with a Jewish father? With a, I can't hear this. Yeah. What is the system there?
Well, just basically, if you fuck it up, you go to hell. Like, that's sort of, like, that's kind of the plan.
You know, the thing about Judaism and hell, it's been very much overstated that Jews don't believe in hell. I think that that's not exactly true. And if you've ever had a Jewish mother, they bring it down to earth with you. Come on, folks. No, but I think that the bigger point of Jews' relationship with the afterlife is they don't care. It's not even that they do or don't. They just – what they care about is doing things right. So – would there be a consequence if things weren't done right? It's possible. I might not even know the answer, but that's not really the point. The point is, like, you want everything to be done really clean and ritualistically and sort of perfect. And that's why they're there. That the moment that the person passes from being here to being not here, there's somebody there to make sure that everything is done according to the law, right? So I was... it led to a funny story, which isn't about grief, but there was a distant cousin who was in the room with me on one of the last days of my father's life. And he said to me, so you're not religious, huh? And I was like, yeah, no. At this point, I was much more confident in who I was an adult, you know, sort of. And I wasn't as embarrassed about who I was. And he's like, can I tell you something? Something I've always wanted to tell someone, but nobody in my life can hear. And I go, yeah, okay, what, you're gay? I'm thinking, you're gay. And I'm like, okay, you're gay. He's like, I need to tell you, you're gay, I get it. I'm like working on infusing sincerity into my acceptance of him because I'm just like, okay, yes, I accept you, it's great. And he goes, I've always wanted to be, I go, yes, gay? And he goes, a lawyer. I go, a lawyer? I go, just fucking be a lawyer. Like, what are you talking about? He's like, oh, no, I could never. My family, no, they would never. It's just so funny. Somebody else's Jewish wet dream is this guy's deepest, darkest secret. This is like, I hope that guy's practicing law somewhere. Anyway, so my dad dies. And there's another story about when I did leave that I'll tell you if it comes up. But immediately, the clip of the Jewish grief and burial ritual, it's whiplash-inducing. It's like day of, he's getting buried, that day. And the funeral's the same day. And it's very surreal. We go to this cemetery, and I'm throwing dirt on my father's grave. And, you know, they put you in this, like, very austere coffin. The Jewish coffin is, like, I really like the Jewish coffin because it's none of that, like, mahogany, Cadillac, velvet. It's, like, plain pine box. And yeah. Then the box is broken into pieces because the box is even too fancy. It's just burial shroud, throw him in the dirt. He's got to roll to Jerusalem someday when the Messiah comes. Do you know about that?
I don't know about that.
The main articulated belief in the afterlife, you were asking about hell. The hell thing is all very vague and unclear. It might be a river of boiling shit. It might not. We don't know. You might stay for up to 18 months. You might stay forever. No one's really clear. Heaven, who knows? But definitely... dead bodies will roll to Israel when the Messiah comes. Now that we definitely do believe. The dead...
Physically roll.
They're rolling, baby. Yes, they are going to roll like a la Tremors. they are going to roll, physically roll to Israel and be resurrected to like mummies. And that used to just destroy me when I was a kid because there's these things called the 13 Articles of Faith that you're supposed to believe. And that is one of them. And as a young, mostly secular kid, I would read the 13 Articles of Faith, and I could kind of like get behind everything, you know? I was like a little kid, so I wanted to be religious like my dad and like believe this stuff. And then it was like, I believe with absolute certainty that the bodies of the dead will roll to Jerusalem. And I was just like, oh, fuck, I'm not going to make it. Like, this isn't happening for me. Like, I can't. I just don't believe that. But anyway, we bury the body. Then you walk out and I think we were barefoot. And we walk out and there was like a gauntlet of Hussets like incanting at me through this like gauntlet. Do you ever watch the episode of Star Trek The Next Generation where Lieutenant Worf is walking and they're like sticking him with pain sticks? I don't know if you've ever seen that. But it was that like that. It was just these Hussets like flanking me on either side. And then you go straight to the Shiva. Now you're in 7 days of Shiva, sitting down in the living room, close to the ground. You can't do anything but grieve. Like, that's it. That's what's so cool about the Shiva, is you're not allowed to do anything. You can't cook for yourself. You can get up and go to the bathroom, and you can get up and go to bed, and that's it. All day long, you sit on the ground, and you're in the same clothes. You don't shave. You don't shower. You just sit. You might shower. You just sit there. If you're hungry, somebody makes you a hamburger, and you sit in the stink of your grief for a full week, and people come to you, and they share their memories of your loved one, and you just grieve, like you grieve deep, and that's the first leg. Shall I continue?
Yeah, no, please.
Okay, that's leg one. Leg one is just like grieve all day, 24/7, grief factory. You can't even look in the mirror. They cover the mirrors because you shouldn't be distracted by your own appearance. You have to just like sit in it. On the seventh day, you get up, and the soul of the dead is said to be hovering in the room at the time. And you just, so it's like, it's this hyper-concentrated version of grief. And three times a day, you get up and you say the prayer for the dead, the Kaddish, and you just sit in that grief. On day seven, there's a great story about the Kaddish, too, that happened at my father's Shiva that I can tell you if you want to know more. But day seven, you get up and you go for a walk around the block. You're done with the hyper-concentration, and you let the soul of the dead or whatever it was, you just let it go, right? But that's not the end of it. Then for the next 30 days, so that's first week, 30 days, you don't shave, you don't listen to music, you don't go to the movies, you don't go to parties, you go back to work, you go back to life, but you're physically altered, you know, you haven't shaved, and so you can see the grief on your face. But it's this, you know, it's a little less than Shiva, but you're still kind of really thickly in it. And you do that, and then you still say the prayer for the dead three times a day. That's for a month. Then at the end of the month, you can shave, you can start to re-enter kind of regular life. I think you're still not supposed to go to parties or go to concerts, because as we all know, the way out of pain, the ultimate distraction is to go see Fleetwood Mac. I mean, that is the thing.
Right, that's the cure.
That's the cure. So you don't want
to. Or, in fact, the cure. You could go see the cure.
Go see, which I, you know what? I have seen the cure, and it's not the experience that you want. So you do that for 30 days. And then at the end of the 30 days, you're kind of back to normal, except that you're still saying three times a day this prayer. And you have to say it as much as you can. And so for the first year, I didn't do it three times a day, but I would, on the Shabbat, on Friday and Saturday, I would go to temple and I would say the prayer. So you're in this state where you're kind of like back to normal, but you're still like aware a little bit. Okay, I'm not quite normal. I'm still kind of in this stage of altered reality. And at the end of the year, you stop saying the prayer. And it's almost like, it almost just felt perfect to me. It was just like these digestible strata of grief. Like 7 days, I can't do anything but grieve. 30 days, I'm mostly grief, but a little bit normal. For the next year, I'm mostly normal, but a little bit grief. And at the end of the year, I'm kind of like, okay, I can kind of re-enter the world. And there is like an annual prayer that you go back to say, it's called Yizkor, which is the remembrance prayer. And that's like for the rest of your life, you're a changed person. You're the person that stays for Yizkor. But that was the strata. Those are the legs.
You delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
You asked before, I think rhetorically, like, what do people do who don't have this faith? And I think the answer that I've gotten from most people that I speak to is just kind of like spiral out and hope for some kind of human connection. And I think that one of the best things that religion can do for people is give them ritual and be like, because then you, like, the beauty of ritual to me is that you have, you take space to be like, something has happened. Like, we're not going to just keep going as if this thing didn't happen. It happened, and so let's live in it for a little while. And even, you know, all ritual weddings are like that too. They're obviously not as sad as funerals, but to give you...
Some are. Some can be.
That's true.
Yeah.
But to give you that time, it sounds invaluable. It sounds like from what you're saying that it was very helpful to you.
I mean, it was incredibly helpful. And to be honest, I think that's what religion in many ways is there to do in the world, period. And sometimes it's false. Like, you know, life is this process of grieving the fact that we're in this incredibly unfair interaction, which is that you're born to die. And everybody knows it. And it's this dawning realization. And you go, really? Everybody I've ever known is going to die. And then I die. And then the people I've known, they'll be dead before me. And the people that came after me, I'm going to have to say goodbye to them. And religion just goes, oh, no, don't worry about it. You want answers? Like, that's what we're here for. We've got all answers. So not to disparage religion in this context, because it was crazy how comforting it was. Like, I was so lost and so sort of just at sea that it just came in with this net of stability. And I think, yeah, the way that I describe what you're talking about is like spiral out is what people do, in my observation, that I don't want to make this like too, you should have religion if you go through grief, because I it's complicated, because it's like, what if you hate religion? There are good reasons to hate religion. But a lot of people, what they do is they're in this sea of grief and they get to the surface and they imagine that because they can breathe again, that they have gotten out of the grief. But in fact, what they're doing is just like desperately doggy paddling. You know, they're barely above the surface. And I had this ability to kind of like process. Now, I don't know if I fully processed it. And by the way, there are other parts of my life that are kind of filled with bizarre grief that I feel like I'm still processing to this day. But at least with that death, it was, yeah, invaluable.
And the other thing about it is that it puts you in context that you might not have. Like, when your dad dies, that suddenly a bunch of dudes you never saw before walk in. Those dudes have done this. Like, you can have a moment of like, oh, these guys have done this a ton of times. They probably did this, you know, 15 times this month. And they'd be like, oh, I'm saying a prayer that somebody said in the desert thousands of years ago. Like this, oh, I'm not alone in this thing. And I do think, again, now it does sound like the podcast is designed to convert people to Judaism.
Great. My mission's done. I guess I can sign off.
Yeah. But I do think that is very valuable. I think for me and my wife and anyone who has lost somebody when you're not expecting to, understanding that you are not alone in it is something that can be extremely helpful. And a lot of people don't have access to.
Yeah, I totally had that experience, and it was the experience of my grief, was like finding comfort in this ancient thing that was like, you know, if like I said, the main feeling I had when in loss was I just don't know what to do, and religion's kind of main functional arm is telling you what to do. That's kind of what it's there for. And at the time, that just couldn't. You know, it's funny. Speaking of AA. Is I did this similar thing with AA, which is that in AA, there are these different kinds of sponsors. There's, you know, like sort of laid back guru types. There's like cool guys that, you know, there's some people that will never tell you what to do. There are these spiritual kind of guru types. And then there's a specific kind of sponsor in AA that is like the tell you what to do guy. And they can be very hardcore. And I sought out at that time in my life, I sought out one of the tell you what to do guys. And I was never a very orthodox thinker in religion. Oh, well, I was more orthodox about AA than I was about religion. But even within that, I was kind of an unconventional thinker in that world. But I got the most conventional sponsor for that year of grief possible. And I didn't do it consciously, but now, it's been 22 years since my dad died. Now I realize exactly why I did that. Like, I needed a big AA daddy to come in and like tell me what to do, and that was his thing. He was like, you got to shave. That was a big, he loved shaving. He was really into shaving. And like, if I had like stubble, he'd be like, what's with the stubble? I go, what does that have to do with AA? He goes, we're here to clean up our act, aren't we? It's like, oh, the kind of logic that is like based on axioms, pithy axioms. You go, oh, clean up, that makes sense. And you go, wait, why are beards unclean? Anyway, so I remember he would have me call him every day. And this was in the year after my dad died. He was an AA guy that would have you call him every day and tell him something wrong because he wanted to tell you what to do. He was very tell you what to do guy. And it made for these very awkward conversations on days when nothing was wrong. It would be so awkward. I'd be like searching through my day like to try to give this guy something. And I remember I said to him, I go, I guess one day I was like, this girl did ask me out, but I'm not attracted to her. So I said no. I was just like looking for something to say.
Yeah. And I know that feeling.
And he goes, huh? Like he had, like it was like a shark smelled blood. He goes, huh? You said no? I go, yeah, well, I didn't find her attractive. I'm not into her. He goes, how has your herb will been doing with your love life? Huh? How's that? And I go, bad. I guess it's been bad. And he's like, yes, bad, very bad. You need to call her and tell her you'd love to take her out. And I was like, oh, okay. So I guess I will. I'm so lost at this time in my life that I'm just like, okay, yes, I'll do it. I'll do that. So I call this woman and I go, I would love to take you out. And she took me out. It was the most awkward date of my life. We basically just sat. And she basically told me for 2 hours that she'd be willing to convert to Judaism if I would marry her. And I'm 20 years old. And I was like, oh, okay. And then I get home to a bouquet, like a $200 bouquet remember the M&M cartoon? Remember the M&M, the anthropomorphic M&Ms?
Yeah, sure.
It was like a ceramic anthropomorphic cartoon M&M with like a dozen roses in it that she had sent. She sent me. It was like, I had a great time. Think about my offer or whatever. And then
think
I called
about my offer.
I call my AA daddy and I told him about the roses. And he goes, okay, yeah, no, maybe that was a mistake.
Oh, good. At least that's good. I expected based on what you told me so far, I thought he was going to force you to marry her.
And that woman is my wife today. I mean, there was another funny thing. This is kind of off topic, but I remember I was 50. I got sober when I was 15. I'm 15 wow. years old. And there's a lot of problems with that. And I write about that in my upcoming book a lot about how as I got older, and this is another big thing of grief that happened in my life, so it kind of connects to what we're talking about, was my eventual, and I think this is a unique kind of grief, my eventual, I haven't been to a meeting in, I don't know, five to 7 years. And I used to be like the absolute ultimate cheerleader. I was what they call a circuit speaker. I used to fly around the country talking at AA conventions. I was the like young guy. That was my angle. I got sober young and save the children kind of a thing. And then one day I woke up and just something had shifted. Something bizarre had shifted in my relationship to AA and the 12 steps. And I related a lot to like waking up one day and realizing you don't love your wife anymore. And you're like, what the hell do I do? Or being incredibly religious and one day waking up and going, I just don't believe this stuff anymore. And I had this long, extremely painful process of extricating myself. It wasn't an extrication at first. At first, it was just like trying to restart the battery of my love for this thing and just failing and failing and failing. And then eventually finding a way to give myself permission to say, I got a lot out of it. I love that part of my life, but it's just not working for me anymore. And very slowly finding a way to give myself permission to do something else, which was very difficult and a very different kind of grief because it was a feeling that died. It wasn't a person. Anyway, I say all that to say, where was I going with that?
It's possible you wanted to just land on that idea of a different type of grief, which is also, I think, You referenced before the grief of like of sort of leaving behind a different person, a person that you used to be, and that feels in line with that, especially if for a lot of your youth you were abusing alcohol or whatever to leave AA. I don't want to be doing armchair therapy. Is to like leave. That seems like a way of leaving that whole person, like that entire struggle, behind.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. You know, I've never quite thought of it like that, but definitely in 12-step, if you stay sober long enough, you can stay sober long enough to feel like the person that you're discussing is a stranger. You know, the diseased person becomes this kind of bizarre stranger that doesn't really have an application to your life, especially, you know, you go through all of these other experiences sober and you just become this really different human being. And like, I don't feel ruled by that trauma anymore. Like, I don't feel like that trauma. And I think that's a lot of the reason that my understanding of what it means to be an alcoholic, or at least to be an alcoholic that gets sober that young, has started to morph into not really understanding if I understand what alcoholism is at all. As certainly not in the modality that was given over in 12 steps, which is that it's this kind of permanent static thing where, just like you said, if my father dies and my grandma dies and my doggy dies, I'm going to think I should drink. You know, that to me is like the kind of classic, the kind of movie version of what alcoholism is. And to me, it doesn't necessarily resonate with me anymore.
I wonder if also, because one of the things you were doing prior to leaving AA is you were speaking about it a lot. So you're like sort of performing the story of your, I don't know what the word is for it, but you're performing the story of your alcoholism, for lack of a mm-hmm. better term. I know that like I talk a lot about my son's death, and a thing that I am constantly conscious of and worried about is that as a comedian, I'm aware of what is most effective. Like mm-hmm. I can tell the difference between, and if I'm just telling a story or telling a joke, I'm trying to affect you the most. I'm not really worried about how true this thing is, because who cares, right? Uh-huh. Like, but when it's something that's personal to me, the more that I deviate from what really happened in an effort to make it more and more effective, the more that I feel like disdain or disengaged from that act, the more that I'm like, I don't think I want to keep telling this. I don't want to mm-hmm. keep talking about this because I've become too good at it in a way that does not benefit me as a person, that hurts me.
Right. And you have a more complicated, I mean, now I'm going to play armchair psychiatrist to you.
Okay, good. Fair is fair.
You have a more complicated relationship with the thing that you're talking about than I did in AA, because I would assume you want to honor the truth of what happened, as yes. opposed to AA has this kind of ability of allowing people to, you know, there's nothing really to honor. What, it's some fucking, you know, degrading period of your life, some, you know, so actually kind of turning up the stink of what went down is kind of, it's a little bit good. Like, you're not really dishonoring the truth of anything. You're kind of like, you're actually, yeah, maybe you're even helping people. So the person that, you know, used to take free cocktails and then go home and fuck somebody now is like, you know, and what is that? That's prostitution. Or, you know, like you might have sold, you know, you sold 4 hits of acid. So then when you go to speak at the AA meeting, you know, there I was, hardcore drug dealer. That's who I was. You know, it's like over the time, you can definitely see the trajectory, having stayed in the program for a long time. You can see the trajectory of people's stories over a decade or so. It's like, wow, you've gotten much more hardcore since you first got sober. Like, I remember when, you know, your story was a little bit softer, but wow, I didn't realize that you were a hardcore gangbanger. Before, you just met a guy in a gang.
But that's not even, you know, just to be clear, I'm not trying to dismiss the validity of whatever it was you did. I'm sure you helped a ton of people with that shit.
I know.
I mean, there
did.
Really must have been lots of people who are deeply moved and whose lives were changed for the better by what you did. But I'm just saying, for you, I could see it becoming hard to continue, like for anyone.
Well, you know, you want to hear something really depressing.
Absolutely.
my life now, I mean, I love my life and I'm really happy and I you know, I've got a great family and, but I don't feel as though I am rippling the world in the way that I used to when I was in the program. My life at that point, it was unsustainable because one day I just was like, I don't think I believe this stuff anymore. I believe parts of it and a lot of it is still really in the framework of the way I live my life. And I'm not an anti-12-step. I know a lot of people are and think it's like dogma and religion. And I mean, it kind of is religion, but I really think it's helpful and very useful and very powerful medicine. But I just, what are you going to do? If one day, you know, I struggled for 5 years to try to make myself believe this stuff and it just wouldn't come back. And now my life is like a lot less impactful, I feel like, you know? I mean, I travel around the world. I mean, comedy is good. People laugh and it's useful to give people a night of joy. I'm not taking away from that. But, you know, yeah, I used to be directly involved in people's lives being saved. And, you know, you take that out, nothing fills that void unless you go purposely fill it. I'm not at the fucking midnight mission ladling gravy on a turkey dinner every night. I'm just like watching Netflix. You know what I mean? Like, so I would have been better off to stay. I remember one thing. This is connected to AA and my dad, and maybe it'll bring us back. I lost my taste for small talk. After, I wonder if you experienced this too. I don't know why, but it felt connected. When my dad died, I was like, I don't want to have small talk in my life anymore. It was such a profound experience that I was like, I don't want to tell to bullshit anymore. And I want to have real conversations or no conversations. So I made this agreement with myself that I was like, I'm not going to tell people I'm doing fine if they ask. They go, how are you? I'm not going to say fine. Because it's not true. And so I would, for like the first year or so, people would say, how you doing? I go, not great. And it's not good. And one guy, I remember I was at an AA convention and this guy who was like one of Tony Robbins' acolytes. He was like an intern at Tony Robbins Inc. or whatever. He goes, how are you doing? It's a big guy, older guy, maybe 50. And I was 20. And he's like, how you doing, man? And I was like, not good. And he goes, why is that? I go, well, my dad died like 3 months ago. And he goes, well, let me ask you a question.
Oh, no.
He goes, do you think your father would want you to be feeling this way right now?
No.
And I go, I don't know. Yeah, probably. I mean, yes. And he goes, well, what if I told you that I could get you to stop feeling bad right now? And I was like, I don't know what. I don't know. And he goes, look up. What? He goes, look up at the ceiling. It's like, okay. So I look up at the ceiling. He goes, now make yourself smile. And I go, all right. So I grin. I'm looking at the ceiling, grinning. And he goes, now think about your dad. And he goes, I go, okay. And he's like, now do you feel bad? I go, yeah, I do. Like,
worse.
Yeah, and worse because I'm talking to some fucking idiot in a convention center in a Marriott looking like an idiot. It was like he had some kind of biometric, like, you know, kinesthesiology trick that he thought maybe if Tony Robbins was doing it, he could have gotten me out of it.
It would have worked.
Not his like 10th in succession.
Yeah, it's one of those things where like, no, people can't possibly feel sad when they're looking up. Like we found 10 studies have shown.
Yeah, it's like, okay. So anyway, people are bizarre. People are very weird around grief.
You were young when your dad died. You were 20, you said, right?
Yeah.
How has the grief changed from like the moments, from you like walking into the room and seeing your dad and feeling like you have to leave to now? Can you talk about the evolution of that feeling?
Well, I think that the parts of that grief, well, here's something that has adjusted. It's like the parts of the grief when it's so raw, you feel really ashamed and bad about the things that went wrong. Like walking into my dad's room and immediately leaving, it took me years to forgive myself for that, you know, just that small thing. And there was another, this is the story I was going to tell you of when I did leave. I remember I'd been in his room for like, you know, 2 weeks. Going home for a shower, coming back, staying up all night. And I was talking to him and he was, you know, conscious, but like diminishing every day. And we got our conversation. It wasn't the one that I wished that I had been able to have because he was so stricken with cancer and stuff. But
what,
you know,
did you say what kind of cancer? I'm sorry, Moshe. What kind of cancer did you have?
He had lymphoma.
Okay.
Does that change the course of our conversation? Do you have a,
no,
a
I
new
just,
tech?
It was okay, yeah, I got to flip to the lymphoma page of my manual. No,
oh,
you got
lymphoma questions?
Sorry.
No. And I remember we had this conversation where, you know, speaking of AA, it's so funny that it's all interrelated, because I went there with this like grand mission to like make an amends to him for, you know, being a kind of whatever I had done. And I started giving this like speech that my sponsor had given me to give, you know, this like ridiculous speech. And I'm like, you know, there were times in my life, and I'm like, it's almost like I'm reciting it. And, you know, there were times in my life where I could have been, and it's like I'm 10 minutes into it, and I look over and he's sleeping. He's fallen asleep in the middle of this speech. And I go, okay, like he's not. And then when he wakes up, I said to him just like, I'm sorry for everything I did wrong. And this was as much as he could process at this point. He was so sick. And he signed back to me, you know, I'm lucky that I remember he signed, and I didn't understand him because he was so addled with the cancer that his hands were barely working. And I made him repeat it because I couldn't understand what he was saying. And I finally got it. And it was like, you know, I'm lucky that you're my son. And I said that I'm lucky you're my dad. And that was kind of like the simple way for me to say goodbye. So I got to do that. But I was there with him and he was conscious, and I just had to get out of there. And I just had been there for so long that I was just like, I'm going to go away and go out for the night. And my dad said, go. And I went to this meeting with this girl and we hooked up that night. And I wasn't even that into it. You know, I was just like looking for comfort, like some a body, just a warmth to, you know, just like give me something. And when I got back from hooking up with her the next morning, he had passed into a coma and he never came back. And that was so shameful to me, that I was like in New Jersey getting a blowjob while my dad was like slipping from consciousness. And it became this huge shame, like, here I was like looking for this carnal pleasure while I could have been there for my father's final moments of consciousness. And all that kind of stuff, all that stuff I now, 20 years later, am just like, I forgive myself for. I know that none of it matters. You know, this thing that happens in grief, I think like the grief is so intense that it becomes the whole relationship. You know, the relationship is like about like how he went and how. And it's like, that's not the relationship. The relationship was all the good stuff that happened before the person got sick, you know? And so I've gotten a new relationship with that. And one thing that happens with losing a parent, I'm curious if it happens with losing a kid, and I would imagine it's less so. But this is negative, I guess. It's like I can go months without even thinking about him. I can go, you know, years, not years, but I can go almost a full year without really thinking about him, without having an emotional moment. And Judaism to the rescue again, on Yom Kippur, when we do the Yizkor ceremony, it's like all of a sudden, you know, it's been 22 years and I can barely think about him. And then all of a sudden, every year when I go to temple and go to that Yizkor ceremony, it's almost like the heavens open up and the membrane, the callus that I've built over my relationship with my father's death kind of gets ripped open just for a moment. And when I say the prayer of remembrance for him, it's like, you know, again, I just get this time travel where I can go back to my grief just for a moment. And now it's comforting. The pain is now comforting, yeah, because it means I still have this relationship with this person. And so that gets ripped open and I feel grateful for that, you know?
And when you talk about forgiving yourself for that shame you felt, like sort of unburdening yourself of it, how did you get there? Is it just time eventually and getting older gave you a different perspective? Or
I think it's definitely that. It's time, and it's watching other people go through their own grief and realizing that people do these things in these really ugly ways. And then you, as the observer, realize like, oh, that doesn't matter. you know? Oh, it doesn't matter that your timing right. was off. Oh, it doesn't matter that you, you know, you decided to go to Burning Man that year and then the person died. Or it, none of it matters. It just doesn't matter. Like, your relationship with the people that you love, that's what matters. Like, not this little minutia that you've decided has great significance, you know? So I think, yes, time and perspective is the was for sure the thing that changed me.
Yeah, I think just to answer the question that you brought up, for me, well, one, I've been working on a show about grief. So I do that puts my son at the fore of my mind more often than he would be otherwise, probably. But even without that, I still think about him all the time, all the time. Yeah. And part of that also, one thing that makes our situation relatively even more unusual is that my son was a twin. So his twin brother is alive. So like I'm every day seeing yeah. my son who is alive, but also the exact genetic copy of my son who is not alive.
Yeah.
So it's I'm constantly, and but for me, sort of as you've said, even though maybe my thoughts of him are more constant, it, most of the time, even if it's painful, the pain is kind of sweet. Like it's nice to have that pain. It reminds me of him in a way that feels good.
You know, there was this great AA speaker that I once heard who had also lost a child, and it was a big part of his story. And he said this really interesting and beautiful thing that his wife and him do. Because, you know, there's this idea that you die twice, right? You die when you die, and then you die the last time a person says your name, the last time that someone who remembers you will call your name into memory. And this AA speaker said that when he makes a reservation at a restaurant, every time they ask for a name, he gives the name of his son who died. And he does that in the memory of him and just so that he can keep kind of his name afloat in the universe. And I always thought that was like a really like sort of strange but way to process grief, but also kind of beautiful. Like and that I think, by the way, having lost someone, and I'm sure it's similar with you, is like, when someone tells me that someone died, now what I do is I, instead of saying, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I mean, I'll say that too. I just remember that feeling so kind and meaningless, you know? I
was like, yes, oh, what? Absolutely.
Tell me if there's anything I can do. Well, there's not. There's nothing you can do, you know? And that's the wrong question. But this is probably a lesson I learned from that AA speaker and from my own grief and from sitting Shiva too, because the whole thing with Shiva in the first 7 days is people come and they just regale you with memories of your loved one. And that's what you do in the Jewish religion too, is you have this every year on their birthday, it's called a yahrzeit, you light a yahrzeit candle. It's a candle that burns for 24 hours. And that's another beautiful thing, is that every year on the anniversary of my father's death, I light this candle. And so I walk in the room and see the candle. I think of my father, and what you're supposed to do is tell stories about that person. So when I meet someone who's, you know, gone through a loss, like generally what I will try to do, if I'm not so uncomfortable, it's not like I'm some enlightened being around death, but sometimes I'm uncomfortable and I just go, I'm sorry. But if it's someone that I know and I love, I'll ask them, you know, what was their name? And I'll just ask them for a memory of that person, because I think that's kind of the way that you want to process grief is not like, God, how hard was it when they died? It's more, tell me something beautiful about that person and then we can keep them alive together.
Oh, I love that. Okay. I wanted to ask you, because you've been so generous with your time, but before we close it out, the last question is, and we've touched on this a little bit, do you think of your dad as being somewhere now?
God, I wish the answer was yes. But I am a true agnostic in that I really don't know. But if I really just don't know. And I really, if I had to bet money, I would bet no. But I think that coming back to that idea of, and this is going to be so corny, but
I can't wait.
But it's true, is that, yeah, my dad is somewhere, because, you know, when I tell my kids stories about him and I see my own sense of humor that came from him, and my brother is a rabbi now, and, you know, that 100%, and my grandma too, you know, in the way that our family operates with these principles that she cared about, you know, like, is my dad in a state of, you know, being somewhere? I have no clue and don't care. but is my father's memory kind of alive in the way that I operate in the world? Absolutely. Yeah. And when I light that candle, am I thinking like, hopefully daddy's looking down and he can see the candle, you know? No, I don't really think so. But I do think that the people that we loved are definitely alive in some way. They do exist in some way because they're with us, right? And I mean, what you're talking about, I mean, you've got a really stark example of it, you know? It's like your son's without question still around because his ancillary is there and his father's there traveling around and talking about him. Like, yeah, that is a kind of existence for sure. What about you? Do you think your son is somewhere?
I mean, really, the answer you gave is pretty identical to my own. Like, I am. So you're the first person to get that question correct. No one's ever gotten it right before.
And you know where your my father and your son are right now? In the Jewish Bible.
Okay.
In contained in the temple, contained in the truth of Judaism. Everybody convert. So that's how you understand it too. It's like
or how I don't understand it. Like sort of right. Like it is hopeless to try to know it. And so like for me it's whatever it is that day. Like however I feel about it, that is as far as anything can be true, that's how true it is. So do I think that he is someplace like listening to this podcast? No, I do not think that. But if my son has a big test at school and is like really sweating it, will I be like, I don't know, Fisher, like if you like look at tests, if that's a thing that you, if you're like hanging out watching him during the test, then it would be cool if you like whispered a couple answers. You know what I mean? Do I think that's going to work? No, I don't think so.
Right.
I don't think so. I don't think he's somewhere like in some kind of corporeal form floating, waiting for me to like meet him in the afterlife and watch my cousin Vinny or something. But I'm open to whatever it could be. And I do feel that he exists in like the ramifications of his existence, sort of like how you're talking about your dad.
Yeah. And like, you know, one of the great mysteries of, you know, there's no need for love. I mean, I guess you could figure out a way to find an evolutionary need for love, but we're horny enough that we could have done procreation without love, you know? Love is and there's no limit to love either. Love is this great mystery. As this other great AA speaker used to say, I don't believe in God, but I believe in love and I can believe that God is love, you know? And it's like, love is this infinite mystery that doesn't necessarily need to exist and is so real and is so infinite and so mysterious and doesn't go away when a person's body dies. And so that thing, that love that I felt for my father, and I'm sure you said his name was Fisher.
Yeah.
And that you felt for Fisher, that is real. It exists. It is permanent and infinite and is here. And I think that, and is altering. It continues to alter me in the way that I interact with the world, the way I interact with my daughter, the way I interact with my faith, the way that my brother interacts with his faith. So that love thing that occurred is here and exists. And so, yeah, I guess my dad does exist. And if you can hear me now, I hope I did him proud on this podcast.
Yeah, I would say there's, I mean, it would have to make him feel good that at least five people who listen to this are going to become Jews.
Yeah,
there's no way.
The only thing he wanted. By the way, you know that he can probably hear this because do you know that when deaf people die, they become hearing? Isn't that beautiful?
Is that a thing?
No, that's not
at all. No. we didn't even talk about your dad being deaf, but I don't want to make you stay here forever. I'm sorry that I was so gullible as to believe that there's a whole I don't know. Okay, anyway, I've humiliated myself.
Speaking of, I'll leave you this.
Okay.
Speaking of gullibility and Jews, do you think that Jews have sex through a hole in the sheet?
I feel very put on the spot. I've heard that it's true. I mean, I have friends who are Jews, but not what I would call that level of Jew. But is that a thing that exists? I don't know.
Now, it's my favorite belief about Hasidic Jews that they have a hole in the sheet. And the reason I love it so much is because it so speaks to the perversion of human beings, which is obviously, Hasidic Jews, if you think about it, do not have sex or a hole in the sheet. Why would they do that? But what happened was Jews have these like prayer garbs, and they're a thing called the tzitzit. It's like something you put over your head, and it's a big square of material with a big hole in the middle to put over your head. And so in these, like, you know, these villages where Jews and non-Jews were living side by side, the Hasidic Jews would hang their laundry out on the laundry line. People would walk by. They'd be like, oh, look at that square of fabric with a hole. And people must fuck through that. That's a logical thing that you would think, right? You go, oh, it's a square with a hole. They must. But that's not why I love it so much. The reason I love it so much is it's such a pervasive myth about Jews that Jews themselves believe it about themselves. Like, almost every Jew I know, and I'm counting you, even though you went to church because your dad's Jewish, are like, yeah, Hasidic Jews fucked through a hole in the sheet. And it's like, no, they don't. They definitely don't. But so it's like, we actually believe it about ourselves. So there's something
I love that.
There.
I like that we can debunk the idea of a sacred glory hole at the end of this podcast.
Sounds like you came up with the new name for my book at the beginning of the podcast. I think I've got the name for your next book at the end. Sacred Glory Hole.
Sacred Glory Hole. Moshe, thank you so much for doing this. This was A Good Cry with Moshe Kasher. Thanks for listening. I hope it helps. A Good Cry is brought to you by Radio Point and HeadGum, with executive producers Alex Bach. I'm talking Sabrina Fonfetter and Daniel Powell. Of course, Richard Corson, and don't you forget Houston Snyder. It is also produced by V. Abigail Lowenthal and mixed and edited by the one and only Ian Sorrentino.
That was a HeadGum podcast.